I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Yeah, good. Are you well? All good?
Very well. Yeah, can't complain. It's... I was driving on track yesterday at Donington, bit of fun there on the bike this morning. Weather's getting better, isn't it? It's starting to get a bit warmer.
Glimmer of hope, isn't there?
Yeah, daffodils are poking out. You can see spring coming. Raises morale.
Yeah, it does. Makes the mood better when it's just not abject misery every time you open the curtains. But yeah, it's good. Oh, although one of my sons is off sick, been off sick for a couple of days, poor chap. But I think he'll be back in tomorrow. I think he's not milking it. He's not someone who's normally ill, so he looked a bit sorry for himself yesterday.
A bit chirpy today.
Yeah. And yeah, other than that, what do you have? Donington, yes, you were racing round lap after lap, or how much do you do when you're there? Whole day?
Depends what I'm doing. So track days are just a bit of fun. Test days, if you're testing for a specific race or a specific car, it was just a track day. So you basically, it's an open pit lane. You can come and go as you please and just do as little or as much as you want. So yeah, it was a nice dry day. It was lots of, you start to really, over the years, you without realising it, you've got lots of people you know, sort of friends you've made. So it's quite a social thing. So yeah, it's a nice day out. And the big rule at track days is keep it out the wall. Don't have, not that you try and crash when you're racing, but it's almost accepted that it's part of the fun, that there's a risk of crashing. But on a track day, you must keep it on the black stuff. You never, ever want to have any problems.
You must get some lunatics, though, no?
But, you do. I don't know. I sometimes feel like I've got a target on my back. People want to say they passed me, I don't know, or they just don't like me. I want to get through. But, yeah, sometimes you see some genuine numpties. I think people just get a bit excitable on a track day that, they're there with their friends. Maybe it's their first one, maybe it's done before, I don't know. But I was at one a couple of weeks ago at Oldham Park, and I think there were 8 red flags by 11:30 in the morning. So a red flag is when somebody either goes off the circuit and they have to stop and close the circuit to get to retrieve the car from the gravel or from the wall, or if the car breaks down. So 8 stoppages in the space of 2.5 hours. So yeah, that wasn't ideal. But as long as it's not you, and if you, yeah, you don't want to run out of fuel. That's the kind of biggest cardinal sin. If you run out of fuel, you've got to give £50 to charity to get recovered, because that's one thing you can't, there's no excuse for that. You can't run out of fuel on the track when you just got, every time you go out, you check your fuel level, make sure you're okay. But yeah, it's great fun. I love the without getting too high and mighty about it all, you get, it's almost like meditation. You have to be so you're concentrating so much in the moment. You're in that real focus that everything else that's happening in your world at that moment kind of is put to the side. And I just love that mental concentration and the excitement and the speed and the danger as well, because it's dangerous. You've got to really pay attention. And I love it. It's great fun.
Good. When's your next one? Have you got one coming up or not so far now?
Oh, I think after Easter, and then I start maybe do some testing. Some races coming up, racing at Donington in the Sports Prototype Cup with Revolution, so that'd be good. But yeah, it's a fun hobby. I do enjoy it.
Good.
But you're into your motorsport, aren't you? I mean, obviously you cover F1, and that's part of your day job.
Yeah, I love it, actually. I've done some sort of track stuff. I'm not very good at it. Done some sort of rally things, go-karting, track stuff. Did a 2-seater GP Masters car with Nigel Mansell, passenger in that. And I think we hit 191 miles an hour and crashed.
Wow.
Crashed at pretty top speed. Well, yeah, we were at City Airport on the runway, and he lost it in braking, because basically we were just in a straight line going as fast as you could. And we just started turning and suddenly realised we were on the grass. And you then realise you're quite near water there. And just sort of, I remember him saying, if I was scared, I had to let go of this button that I'm holding on to. And he was very impressed but I think it was just out of fear that I didn't let go of the button the whole time. I'm just holding on to it. We came back to the pit crew and everyone was looking pretty nervous. There was like a sort of diver getting ready to get in the water, but he seemed to think it was all under control. But I think briefly we may have broken the world record for the fastest car ever traveled in London, and then I think someone broke it moments later. But yeah, but I think 191 we hit, which is pretty fast when you break at 191 in one of those cars. But great fun, loved it.
So today, who's our guest? Who's our special guest?
We've got Mark Watson on today, who I'm actually really excited by, a big fan of his. Now, he hails from Bristol, which is obviously where I live, but not where I'm from originally, but I believe he comes from Bristol. I think he's a Bristol City fan, but also he's a big snooker fan, hosts a podcast with Stephen Hendry, the, I want to say, 8-time world champion, but it's possibly wrong. We can edit that.
Seven, I think. That's a guess, but I just, in the back of my mind, as a Scot, you know, when I was growing up, there weren't many world champions from Scotland, and Stephen Hendry was most definitely one of the biggest names in sport.
I think you're almost certainly right, and I'm wrong.
It's a guess.
7 world titles.
Yes.
Top of the class.
There you go. There you go.
You should be a sports journalist, or I should not be a sports journalist.
Good at contradicting people, that's all.
Yes, so anyway, he should be, he's great fun. I've seen him stand up before. Have you seen him before?
I have. I saw him at the festival years ago, and I met him. We did a panel show together, and I can't remember if it,
he thought it was 8 out of 10 cats, but wasn't 100% sure.
So that would have been about 2008. Gee whiz, yeah, long time ago. But he was a lovely man. He was one of these people who, you know, you meet folk on these shows and they're all lovely. But there's ones that are lovelier, and he was one of the lovelier ones. And just very genuine, exactly the same off camera as he is on camera, just very funny and relaxed and interesting. So yeah, excited to be chatting.
Yeah, he seems to be into his sport, certainly the snooker and football. Mm. I'm sure there are others as well. I think he may have done a football-related program as well, but I mean he'll tell us. And I think he's on tour at the moment, so he's in the midst of a tour, so this is a sort of mini break while he's traveling around. And you had a listener message from our one listener, didn't you?
Oh yes, yeah. I'm beginning to think we might have two or three listeners now.
We had your gardener,
Steve the gardener. Yeah, we know Steve exists. I know he exists, but I know that he's a listener. Clayton got in touch to say, Clayton's wife got in touch to say that he's been enjoying listening to Sporting Misadventures. He's had some health issues, which means he's got to keep his heart rate down. And every day his little routine on the bike is to get on the bike, exercise within a certain limit. And apparently he listens to our podcast. And I was absolutely delighted to hear that. And then I started thinking, well, actually, maybe he listens to us because it's so unexciting that his heart rate doesn't elevate beyond the level that's been set.
Oh, maybe,
it's a massive insult.
Very damning praise.
But listen, either way, Clayton, if you're listening to this, wish you all the best. I hope your recovery is going well, your rehab's going well, and we'll try not to make it too exciting so you don't get your heart rate up too much.
I think there's no danger of that from us, is there?
We'll see.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello, both of you.
Hey, Mark.
How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Should I have headphones on, Matt, or either of you?
No, either's fine. We're not that professional, so it's...
We just do it to look professional. It's not attached to anything. I just got it hanging out here.
It does make you look like a real podcast. There's no doubt about it.
You've got to fake it till you make it. That's what you do.
I do have a fancy microphone, and I once set that up without it being on, just to sort of convince the too much hassle. I couldn't get it to work against the time limit, so I was just like, fuck it, if I just sit here with a microphone, and it works. People are like, yeah, that sounds great.
Anyway, how are you keeping? What's happening in your life at the moment?
I'm touring around a lot. I'm in the middle of just past halfway in this massive tour. I'm doing that. I mean, sort of slightly relevant to the podcast, tomorrow I'm going to San Marino to watch San Marino play with my brother who specializes in like niche sporting, because they've got this friendly against St. Kitts, which they're hoping will be their first win in like a million years or something. So I've carved out a day off. We've got an incredibly early flight to Italy, and then so that's fun.
There must be two of the lowest ranked teams.
San Marino are the lowest ranked team in the world, but it's partly because they always have to play you know, big, well, decent European size. So there's potentially worse teams out there that are just get to improve their ranking by playing, you know, it's just, so it'd be a good test of, it should be quite fun, I think. As ever, it's just worrying about Ryanair getting us there and stuff like that. But if we do get there, it'll be fun.
What other niche ones have you done with your brother? That's brilliant. I love that.
Oh, my brother does all sorts of stuff like this. He does a podcast called The Sweeper, which is a European football podcast, but it specializes in these very little known stories. He published a book about, he was a manager in Micronesia. He's managed in Mongolia as well. Oh, wow. He'd be good on this podcast, actually. His whole thing is a bit like sporting underdogs and unknown sporting communities and stuff. But I rarely get to go with him because by the time my tour dates are planned so far in advance. So anything like the football season, you know, music, gigs, anything, I can never plan around them. I just have to put my dates in and then sort of cross my fingers that there's gaps. Sometimes it works out. Sometimes you just get a day off. I'm only ever touring 3 or 4 a week, but a lot of it is the back end of the week. So I can just about get away with this. I mean, I could still, my show's in Luton tomorrow night. So if the flight back is delayed, not tomorrow, the next night, that could still all go to hell as well. I'm taking a gamble here, but you've got to sometimes.
I always remember, like, San Marino was a country that really stood out as a Scotland football fan, you know, in the 90s as a kid growing up. There were certain countries and teams that you were like, we've got a chance. You know, we have got a chance here. Faroe Islands.
The Faroes,
San Marino. Yeah, they were always the ones like, we might have to grind out a 1-0 win here. This could be a big victory. And it was genuinely one of these ones you get excited about. But it would always be 1-0 and it'd be grinding out along, you know, it'd be right to the 90th minute and they'd pop one in at the end and you'd be like,
the players feel the pressure of if we don't win this, we might as well give up. But I mean, things have moved on a long way for Scotland since then.
Yeah, it's in all sport as well. You know, we were chatting before you came on about Stephen Hendry, you know, your co-host for your podcast, your snooker podcast. And or just for reference, by the way, I got his number of world titles correct. Matt,
I was close.
He was wrong. Good.
I gave him an 8 for some reason. I don't know why.
But I think he's not.
He deserves an 8. He deserves it, but he hasn't got it. It's a bit like Lewis Hamilton, really, if you think about it.
Yeah, in a way, he doesn't deserve it anymore because he openly talks about how he can't really be asked with snooker anymore and he's much more interested.
But I mean, growing up and watching Stephen Hendry, you know, he was, well, still is a legend of the sport, obviously. But there weren't many Scottish world champions. And in general, the team sports, there was just a lack of funding and facilities and opportunity. But it's very different now. And, you know, rugby is a great example. You know, we're watching the Six Nations and, Scotland, the match against France, that was outrageous, I thought, that try that wasn't allowed.
That was a mad game, yeah. And before that try, Scotland should have been 10, 15 points up there. That was just... But it's the best Scotland, the best shape Scotland team have been in for a long time, I think. And when I was growing up, England losing 3 in a row to Scotland would have been impossible, especially at Twickenham.
Unthinkable.
Expect to beat them now, which is weird.
It was, I mean, it was a defining moment in my childhood when Scotland beat England in the 1990 Grand Slam decider. That was unbelievable. And it was always, you always felt like this is a once in a lifetime, once in a generation that will beat England. And as you say, 3 in a row now, it's so weird. The weirdest thing, though, I think, is when you're watching and you don't have that feeling of, we're winning by 3 or by 6, but we're going to throw it away. There's no way they're going to hang on until the end. And now you can be confident 10 minutes to go, we've got this. This is all right. Although it's alien to us.
I've got a couple of Scottish friends who still do expect the worst all the way through. That Wales game where you'd like 20 points up, I was texting. They were, at least one of my friends was texting going, shut up, this is not over. And I almost did feel as if they'd lost that, it would have been... Yeah, that 1990 game was defining moment in my sort of child as well, but in the wrong way, because I was absolutely at the time, because I hadn't seen England win in a Grand Slam either, and it was, and I think we went in as big favourites because England had steamed.
Was that David Soule as captain?
David Soule walking out.
I really remember that very well.
The menacing the flower of Scotland, all of it. It was quite sort of scarring. We then beat Scotland in the World Cup semi the next year, and almost identical game. A terrible game.
was that when it was like 6-3 or something, or 9-3 or
Gavin Hastings missed an easy kick, didn't he?
The penalty, and then So that sort of, and then England did win the Grand Slam, so it was all right. But certainly that one at Murrayfield was quite bleak, because it was, England had so much hype that year. Scotland had sort of sneaked up to three wins without anyone noticing. And yeah,
it was epic. And it was, yeah, people were like Tony Stanger, who scored the winning try.
Yeah.
Absolute heroes for the rest of their life. That one try,
I can,
he will always be remembered.
I can picture the try. I can picture Bill McLaren with his, like, unbiased, but obviously very, very excited. I've still not been to Murrayfield. I mean, I've been past Murrayfield dozens of times, but I've never been in. That is quite high on my list of sporting venues to see a game.
Just, you'll have to.
Always looks amazing on the atmosphere.
Yeah, I used to live, my parents' house used to be 5-minute walk from the stadium, so you'd see all the crowds coming in and the atmosphere, right. And it just loved it. And your friends would come round and have sausage roll and beans before we'd head down with our schoolboy enclosure tickets. And then you'd run onto the pitch at the end and try and pat, you know, on the back at one of your players from your team. It was just, and then go back and watch the replay. You'd record it on your VHS and you come back in and watch it and rewind at the end and see if you could see yourself in the distance running on the pitch at the end. I patted Damien Cronin in the back once, and I got the telly, my yellow and grey anorak, patting this giant of a man. Right, that was about 10.
Yeah, that culture of everyone just running on the pitch at the end is gone a little bit, because they take it a bit more seriously than they used to. But
yeah, you can't do that these days. But good times. But yeah, so rugby's a big sport of yours in terms of one that you follow.
Yeah, my dad's a big rugby fan, football fan as well. But he brought me up to watch rugby, and when I was a kid in the 80s, my mum thought football was too dangerous to go to. She was right, basically. You know, terraces, then a lot more violence and stuff. So we were in Bristol. I wasn't allowed to go to Bristol City. Well, my mum wouldn't sign it off, but we had a good rugby team. So so I grew up watching rugby. Yeah. And my dad, he still loves the Six Nations and everything. I mean, it's funny looking back though, the rugby has transformed completely since those days, really. Like, this is late 80s, early 90s. We had season tickets at Bristol, and mine cost like a tenner for the whole season, I think. And even my dad's one, they hardly checked them, to be honest. And I've got loads of programs from that era and stuff. And yeah, half the players, well, firstly, it was fully amateur. So our fullback played for England for a bit, John Webb, but he also was just a surgeon. After the game, he'd just go off to the hospital and be like setting people's arms in plaster. He's an orthopedic surgeon. And it's amazing to look back on it, because that was top level as well. Like, we were in the top division, but there was just, well, obviously even the international games, you'd Bill McLaren or Nigel Starmer, the commentators would always come out with it'll be popular down the police station on Monday.
Yeah, the good old days. It's changed so much as well physically, isn't it? Since the game became professional, you look at the guys, like I'm talking about Gavin Hastings and, you know, the 1990 era, 80s into 90s, even, you know, the back, even the forwards, you know, second row forwards, they were big, huge, tall guys, but they weren't particularly, like, compared to these days, they weren't that big, you know, muscularly. No. And now it's like, the rules have stayed the same, the game itself has stayed the same, but the players are probably 20, 30%, 40% bigger and heavier and stronger.
Oh, yeah, and the backs in that era, you wouldn't recognise them as rugby players at all now. Like, I suppose you still get, your scrum half and fly half might be slightly smaller and nippier, but not, like, they're still big, solid guys. I remember Bristol scrum half, Richard Harding, was an estate agent, and again, he was in England, he was capped, he was top level player, but he still looked like an estate agent. And, but also the mentality of the game is so different compared with any other sport I think that I've seen evolve, in that, like, that 9-6 game was pretty common. When I look back to those games, the Bristol games, so many 9-9s, 12-9s, 3 penalties, maybe a drop goal. You didn't necessarily expect to see any tries at all. the whole of the Five Nations, as it was, would go by, and you'd only see England might get a couple of tries again. The Kolkata Cup, it was, you sort of expected it to just be all penalties, and maybe. But like, when Stanger scored that one try, you were like, oh, we've lost this. And you see teams kick to the corner, like decline easy penalties very early in the game. My dad and I are still amazed by it when teams go for the try rather than that mentality just wasn't there. No one ever ran a penalty or went for the corner unless it was desperate times, basically. Now it's also that I was thinking when England beat Ireland with the last minute drop goal, you sort of don't see that much these days either. It used to be England's go-to used to be just stay within range and then we'll win it with a, and obviously Wilkinson was the king of that. And now, again, I watched the Italy-Scotland game and that could have been decided by a last minute drop goal, but that mentality isn't really there anymore. It's just everyone goes all out for tries. It's a much more exciting game, but it means Bristol played Bath, the derby this season, and I wasn't there, but the score was something like 51-43 or something.
And was that the highest scoring game of all time, wasn't it?
It was
top five or near enough.
Yeah, it was about like 9 tries in the first half alone. That's as many tries as you get in years of Bristol v Bath.
What are the defensive coaches doing though when you watch a game like that?
I don't know whether it is just much more difficult to defend now, because, or rather, it's not any more difficult to defend, but just if you do attack that regularly, you're going to get tries. It's just people just didn't used to think like that. It was just a pure game of territory. It's funny because I sometimes see people do down rugby, union especially, by they'll post videos of just the amount of kicking. And sometimes it does, like that Scotland-France game, there was a lot of ugly kicking back and forth. But actually, the game is way more all action than it's ever been. Those people should have been watching rugby in the 80s. And it was proper grim.
And it would be... Yeah, exactly. I guess now there's the incentive of the extra point, the bonus points. There's, you know, even back to, you know, talking about the Five Nations when it was only 4 points for a try. So, you know, versus 3 for a penalty, you think, well, just keep kicking the penalties and you know, it all adds up.
Yeah, I remember when it changed for 5-point try and it seemed like a, you know, huge, wild change. But looking back, it's pretty mad that you could only get one more point for a try than a penalty. Yeah, as you say, why wouldn't you just kick the points? Especially... Mm. Kickers weren't as good then either, so you weren't guaranteed the conversion. So, yeah, the effort of getting tries was, and let alone bonus points. And all, they've changed the rules to make it a more. It was even like, I don't think you got the throw in after a penalty into touch in those days. So everything was geared towards the defence being on top, basically. And, also, what goes along with that is my memories of watching in that era was you weren't undercover. We were just standing on terraces, even in what was quite a nice ground by the standards. It was still, you were just there in the pouring rain watching this scrap on a muddy pitch. It was like, when I go to rugby now, which I still sometimes do, but there's like music for tries and obviously the stadiums are much better. It's much better experience in most ways, but a part of you is nostalgic for when rugby was just a bit of a sort of, a fight in the
punch up in the mud
swamp. Yeah.
Do you know what other thing that has occurred to me? We used to, you know, whenever there was a high ball kicked up to the fullback standing under it, waiting for it to come down, it was always 50-50 really, if he's going to catch it or not. Like they rarely drop the balls now when there's high kicks. They drop it, and even then, you know, when they're having to jump to sort of, you know, there's a defender, there's an attacker coming at them, and they've got to jump.
Yeah,
they still catch it. They're 9 times out of 10.
Definitely, they'll take a mark nearly every time. Yeah, that is a big change. Like that guy John Webb, who again was England level, and he was a good penalty kicker. But I do remember if you saw him under the high ball, you're like,
But there was a great picture of Freddie Stewart earlier in the Championship, and the air. I mean, it's probably slightly false perspective of how it's been taken, but it looks like he's miles in the air with how high he's got up. It's unbelievable. I mean, he's great at the high ball.
But the catches they take are astonishing. Now you didn't see. Fullbacks take the catch in the air like that. And so again, there was way more of that. That Bill McLaren thing of that's coming down with snow on it. You'd see that just one of the go-to tactics you'd see was just a massive kick hefted into the air and hope for someone to get it. Again, I suppose it all comes with the sport being more scientific as well. There were no attack and defence coaches in those days and obviously no tactical subs. In fact, you weren't even allowed any subs in those days. You had to pretend to be injured. So yeah, it's sort of, the game's gained a lot of quality, but it's maybe lost a bit of innocence as well.
I wonder if the ball, the surface or the sort of rubber coating on the ball has improved. I can remember when it rained, the balls we played with at school at rugby, it was like a bar of soap. You know, once it got wet, you just, you know, there's no way you're going to catch it. It's like kind of juggling around. But nowadays, they're catching it one hand and sort of, you know, throwing it as if it's like they've got, you know, there's some sort of adhesive on their fingers. It's incredible that the technology is clearly advanced as well.
You can't help suspecting the balls are actually better and easier to work with. Some of the handling, the trickery that you see, all these passes out the back and like stuff like that is, I tell you what else reminded me of the old days was that France Italy game when the ball fell over and he had to reset it. And these days there's a shot clock and it sort of cost them the game. But again, when I was a boy, that happened every game. They could never keep the ball up. The wind would always blow it over.
Oh, someone would have to come over and hold their finger. Yeah.
Someone's finger would have to be on it. Yeah, it was. Or they'd, rather than prop it on the tee, they'd dig a hole and like sink it into the, all sorts of, again, it was, it all seems so ancient now. And so that was I felt sorry for the Italian guy, but that was a real blast from the past, actually, seeing the kicker.
Mark, you're like this. We had Jack Whitehall on, and when he used to play rugby at school, he was their kicker for, he downplayed it. He was getting lower and lower. He was about fourths or fifths by the time he told his story. But he used to take his boot off to kick, and he'd kick either barefooted or just in his sock. Yeah. And he was amazingly, freakishly good at it. There's actually some sort of old family footage of it. But anyway.
Must have still had one of those thick rugby, old school rugby socks.
He had a very badly swollen fit, he'd say at the end of the game.
Oh, I bet he did. Yeah, you're not meant to remove your boots for that.
It's a quite weird thing to do.
By the time it would take to get your boot back on and lace it all up and you've got a wet sock full of mud, it's just, yeah.
Totally. That, again, we had to play rugby at school and to get your boot off was a sort of 5-10 minute job after you came off coated in mud. I remember one time having the boot just stuck on, the laces were just like trapped under all this mud. And I just couldn't, and the bus was leaving to take us back to school and I was just, I had to get on the bus with half my school uniform still on. Terrible, terrible stuff. I was no good at rugby, even though I was a big fan. So it was really, a lot of the kids just hated it outright because it was cold and wet and horrible. But I wanted to be good at rugby, but I'd always be stuck out on the wing. The ball never got out there because we weren't good enough. And if you did get the ball, you didn't really want it because someone had just hammered you.
So was rugby, other sports you were interested in or took part in when you were a kid, or was rugby your main one?
Football, I'm massive football fan. As soon as I could start going, and even before I could go to football, I had a really nerdy interest in it. I started collecting football programs very, very early on. I think I started collecting them because I got a program when we went to the rugby, but I soon started picking up programs anywhere, anyone going to a game, I would ask them, which I still do. I've got quite a lot of them now, probably more than, like, when you're a middle-aged man, it doesn't really make sense to, they're just in boxes. I look at them all the time, but it's not, no partner I've been with has ever found it particularly attractive. just one more thing. I've been moving my 12 boxes of football programs in. at some point, everyone I've been in a relationship with has hinted that it might be time to sort of cut back in some way. Or they say, why don't you put them on display? Like, get, and I have got a few of them framed, but as with any collection, I'm not that interested in showing them off to people. I just have them. And I used to do stuff like, just watch teletext all afternoon on a Saturday, watch the goals come in. I'd write reports on the televised games like I was a sort of journalist. I was very sort of, I had a very kind of, I think partly because, Bristol City then were in the third tier for most of us. So even when I could go, it was very poor a lot of the time. So I didn't have the sort of the mentality of like, I was never a Liverpool fan, or the glory hunters at school were all Liverpool and then became Man United when I was at university. But I sort of made peace quite early in life with the fact we were never going to be a great club. So then my interest in football wasn't really about the glory. It was just about the nerdy details and their, and as my brothers followed in that as well. Our dad was a big football fan, but I think he was surprised by how we sort of, took it and ran with it. I'd sort of play anything at school though, and as a kid I loved playing cricket, but again no real talent for it. And again, you know, when I say I love playing cricket, I love the theory of it, but when the ball is coming towards you at that speed, again you sort of think I'm better off out here, actually. I don't really want to face this guy. I remember getting out in a school game to a spinner completely deceived by the ball, but I remember walking away thinking that is for the best because the other bowler was a fast bowler and I didn't want him coming anywhere near. My best moment in school cricket was I was in a partnership of about 40 or something, to win a game, but I didn't get any runs at all. The other guy was really good. I just ran back and forth every time he shouted at me.
You were like the Jack Leach role to Ben Stokes.
I was Jack Leach. I was actively not looking to take strike at any point. I knew that I wouldn't be. I knew that my only value to the team was just to get away from the striker's end as fast as possible. Yeah. So on the scorecard, I think I was out in the end for zero, but I'd been there for about 50 balls. I just hardly faced any of them myself. Proper team player. And also tennis, snooker. I was basically, I've always been into, even past year, I've got into playing squash. Never played squash before, but my mate is a player. He had a squash partner pull out of a game. So I just went on a whim and started playing him. And I've got quite sort of obsessed with it now, because at first I was just messing about, but now I've got just about good enough that I can give him a game. So that means I'm now furious that I keep losing to him. So I started trying to find other people to play with. And that, again, I've never even thought about squash till last year, but I've never lost that instinct for, I've never had a game or sport that I'm particularly good at, but I am very competitive. I'll give anyone a match at anything.
Squash was massive in the 80s, wasn't it? It became the thing that everyone was getting into, and then it seemed to sort of just drop out of favour, or maybe it didn't, but it wasn't as prominent, and people didn't talk about it as much.
No, you're right. I hadn't thought about it at all for years, and I think it's still got quite a low profile. Like, it's only now been added to the Olympics, I think, for LA, which seems crazy, really, because it's...
Well, when there's breakdancing and, you know, skateboarding, and nothing wrong against breakdancing or skateboarding, but, you know, all these other sports that are brand new that are coming in, and squash for so many years has been trying to get that recognition.
They've definitely got a case that they're closer to being a sport than breakdancing. I'm not quite sure what I think it must be that it's just not an amazing, it's not a great spectator sport, not easy for telly because you're behind the players and all that. I think
it's great to watch. Was it not the argument there weren't enough nationalities?
Or maybe it's bad.
That it's not a global enough, maybe I'm wrong there, but actually when you watch it now, they have them in their sort of proper glass courts, and actually watching some of those rallies they do is brilliant. It should be.
It's true, and I have seen clips like that because it's part of my class, and I've started watching the pros to see the difference is they're just... As with anything, it looks so easy. They seem like that. Like when I come off, I'm absolutely exhausted. I feel like I've hit the hell out of the ball every time. When you watch the best players, the rallies go on and on, and they never seem like they're hitting it very hard or moving around at all. It's like any sport. If you're already good enough to read the game, you don't have to charge about like a maniac.
It's funny though, because squash, I played it a little bit at school. Like I tried it for a short while. And it's ridiculous, but the reason that I didn't really enjoy it was because of the smell. I don't know if it's all squash courts. It's just that smell of feet and the smell of sort of rubber. I don't know where the rubber comes from, if it's the ball or the shoes, the sole of the shoes that are getting sort of squeaked onto the floor. But it's that rubbery feet smell I was like, do you know what? This isn't for me.
Yeah, but if you're going to be spending 20 years of a career in that smell, you want to make sure, at least compared with being out.
Velodrome was quite airy, you know, it's not so bad. Yeah.
No, even the velodrome, it can't be. You know what? I don't think that's changed very much. I think very much pictured the same smell that you're talking about. Yeah. But I guess especially at school, a school squash court was kind of, it's the sort of place where people would sneak around and get up to other stuff as well. Yeah. It's a funny game because it's sort of, I think with tennis is very hard. If you're not very good at it, even to just regularly get the ball over the net, is you soon get discouraged. But with squash, because you're just smashing it against the wall, you can get to a decent level almost immediately. But then the actual skills of it, I tried playing with a guy that's like a club player, but not particularly outstanding, I don't think. But just to see how a real player goes about it, and it is interesting. He beat me very easily, but. He wasn't moving around that much. He just stood in the middle, and whatever I did, he already anticipated it. So I wasn't able to, because the playing area is so small. It seems like there's only so many shots you can ever play, and yet, so you feel like if I stay in the point, and if you're fit enough, you can always cover. You'll always get to the ball, but a good player can just always outmaneuver you because they already know what you're gonna. I suppose it's like any sport. If someone's been playing for long enough, then they already can outwit you. It's that thing about it being mostly in the brain is very true, I think. Even if you've got the same technique as them, you can't learn to understand the game like that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's, it must be, it's the same in everything, isn't it? The real professionals make whatever they do look easy. Same as yeah. when you're on stage doing your comedy, you know, doing your routines. It's just yeah. everybody looks just, it looks natural, it looks effortless. And then you only yeah. realize it when you see people that aren't that good at whatever it is that they were talking about. And they make it look incredibly difficult, and you think, "Oh God, that looks awful."
Yeah, squash is a good example because again, it looks so relaxed on the telly or on a YouTube clip. They, the when I'm serving, I sort of like I hear myself like yell like a tennis player at Wimbledon. I put in just so much beef into it just to, but then the professionals, the serve, they hardly even they just toss it casually because the serve isn't important to them because they know they're playing 40 shots in the rally anyway. Everything's like that. It is, and I think we undervalue how difficult it is to play sport at a top level or ride a bike at your level. Well, it is a sport. Like anything looks easy when someone's good enough, does it? I often think, you know, this mentality people have of you'll be in a pub watching the football, like a Premier League game, and someone goes, "It's rubbish. I could, if you gave me that money, I could play that." And a lot of people genuinely believe that. I saw a thing on Twitter where they. During the World Cup in Qatar, someone did a tweet saying, imagine you've been accidentally picked for England or like there's been an admin error. How long do you think you could bluff it as a real player? And a surprising number of people were like, I reckon I'd get away with it for half an hour. You know, after. But you, even the way you walked on the pitch and, you know, your positional awareness, like if you had to play left back for England, you'd instantly be in the wrong place all the time. Like, let alone the actual skill. Even I go to watch Orient sometimes. I live in East London. I take the kids to, then that's like League One. You'll see some pretty poor looking football and you'll hear people say, I could have scored that. But again, it's as soon as you play a five-a-side game with amateurs, you're reminded that you're not even the best player on that pitch. It's because, you know, what Raheem Sterling or someone, what he does is so, so hard and he does it with such brilliance that then when he does mess up, people are like, see, he's never any good. It's a rough thing about being an elite sportsman that you've set a bar that is so high that then if you mess up at all, people talk like you're an absolute idiot. Football's the worst trick. Everyone down the pub thinks he could have been a footballer, obviously.
I think F1's bad as well because everybody think, A, it looks, because the drivers are so good and the cars are so advanced, there's not much happening. At rallying, they're sort of fighting the wheel and you know there's more going on. F1, it's just, you know, steering, yeah. straight in, back out. Yeah, I could do that. Yeah, these rubbish that, you know, Mazepin yeah. or, you know, the back of the grid, I could beat these guys. And they have no idea what it's like. I mean, I have no idea. I'm into motorsport. I do a bit of racing at much lower levels. So I've never even got close to driving a Formula One car. But my God, the skill these guys have,
oh, yeah.
it's off the chart.
I know for a fact I wouldn't even be able to sit in a, I wouldn't be able to be a passenger in a car that, traveling at that speed. I'd be screaming until they let me out. I think. Yeah.
Funny you should mention that because Matt's got a little story you mentioned at the start, haven't you?
Oh, Matt? Yeah. So I can't believe I'm telling this twice in a day, but I went in a GP Masters car, which was like, they did a sort of, it was like Formula One for older guys who'd post-retirement. So there was, you know, Nigel yep. Mansell. So I went in a two-seater with him at City Airport in London.
Mansell?
Yeah. And we went 100, we hit 191 miles an hour. which briefly was the world record, I think, for fastest car travelled in London. I think that was the speed. But then he sort of slightly got something wrong, so he started spinning out of control onto the grass, and there's sort of water there, and slightly precarious moment. But I was saying to Chris before that Mansell said, whatever you do, you hold on to this button. If you're scared, want me to slow down, just release the button. But I held on to the button the whole way, but just out of abject terror, I think I'd forgotten that was what I was meant to do if we were going to.
Yeah, I think adrenaline would completely kick in for me at that point. I wouldn't be able to remember what it's nice that there is, at least is a mechanism for that.
But in theory, yeah, but not if you're too scared to release it.
And once you've got to nearly 200 miles an hour, you wonder how quickly he's going to.
It was the braking from that speed was just, it just felt like you were just being absolutely hurtled forward. It was extraordinary.
Oh, absolutely terrifying. The idea of spinning onto grass in that situation. Imagine dying in a car accident, but the driver was Nigel Mansell. You'd feel like you were pretty unlucky, I think.
Front page news.
Yeah, you wouldn't even get mentioned, would you? Nigel Mansell. It all passenger. About that. Yeah,
that is. Again, when you get a glimpse of, I'm always in awe of any sport really like that. I've been to Wimbledon a couple of times. You sit courtside Wimbledon, you see how hard and how accurate they drive the ball again and again. It's just like, again, on the telly, it looks quite easy, but if you've ever been on a tennis court or snooker is a good example. Again, when you look down a real snooker table from the bolt cushion and imagine what it'd be like to try and make a century break. It's insane. Anyone can do it, really. But again, snooker in particular looks pretty easy on TV, I think, because the table obviously looks quite small. And once they get in the rhythm of knocking the balls in, it looks like it's almost impossible to miss. But yeah, you've only got again, snooker's the sort of thing people are quite macho about. They play a bit of pool and they think snooker's more or less the same thing. But I mean, even to put a sort of, a couple of reds and a couple of colours together is beyond the skill of most people we meet.
So what would be your, if you had a sporting high moment in all the different sports you've tried at school, after school, whenever, what would you say is your one moment that was the peak so far?
So far, thank you. I mean, hopefully if this squash career takes me to, I did beat this guy. I've had a couple of wins over him in the number of games, and those have felt like towards the peak of my, especially because as you get to match point, you really tense up, and which is stupid because you're not playing for anything. But what I regard as my best moment was, we had a house rugby tournament, and I was 13. And as I mentioned, I always play out on the wing, mostly didn't get the ball. We were not a good team as well, but we had one good player. And during the semi-final of this, I say semi-final, within six houses in the tournament. So we must have won one game already, which is more than we expected to, into the semi-final. The bloke that was a good player in the team, our fullback, angled a kick sort of towards the corner. So and the bloke on the other team got to the ball first, but he grounded it thinking he'd taken it over the line for a dropout, but he hadn't. He was slightly short of the line. So I just had to pick the ball up and carry it about 2 meters and fall over. But the try was given, and it was the first and only try of my competitive career. But also, we then won that game by a point and went into the final. So I was the hero. But I was only playing at all because our regular winger had broken his arm. And for the final, he was fit again. So the teacher dropped me to the bench despite my heroics in the semi. And to be fair to that teacher, I've had about 30 years of, well, not 30 years, but ever since I've had a media platform, I've rinsed him for this in a number of I first mentioned it on Fighting Talk on Five Live, but it must be 15 years ago now, not having even thought about it for a bit. And the teacher got in touch with me within 24 hours to say, look, I've said I'm sorry. So even
I'm just impressed at how fast the guy's, broken arm healed. I mean, you know.
I know.
To bring him in for the final, that's incredible.
It can only have been about 2 weeks after the semi, so maybe it was just a sprain or something. And he was much better than me, but and obviously the teacher's got to make those calls. But we did win the final as well, and I was very pleased. I remember running onto the pitch to congratulate them, but there was a little bit of the Jimmy Greaves not being in the sixth final.
If that was your high, have there been low points or calamities or sporting misadventures, as we'd call them?
Well, yeah, I mean, this wasn't a specific well, there's no one specific calamity, but we used to also at school have a swimming gala. And I was hated swimming, but I could swim. So I wasn't eligible to, I couldn't like get a sick note on the grounds that I'd drown or anything. Two or three years in a row, I had to swim. They do it one race at a time. And I would be in the, whatever race I was in, I was always behind by miles. And, but the whole school had to come and watch, I think, or certainly the whole year. So it'd be a public bath with hundreds of people. And just the feeling of just, once everyone else is finished and you've still got a length to go and the whole of the school is just watching you like desperately slog through and you, the other people in your house are pissed off because you're also, you're not getting any points. It's just, it was proper kind of getting out of the water, dripping wet, and the winner of the race is already like already in their clothes. It was, that was continual kind of continual misery for me. But in a way, because I've not had a successful sporting career in any field, I don't think I've had any kind of moments of, well, although actually I do remember my brother and I entered, we got a team together and entered a five-a-side tournament in Southeast London where we used to live, because this is mid-20s. We were not bad players. And we got together what we thought was quite a good team and we were quite bullish about it. And then we got there and the atmosphere was absolutely feral. All of these, like all the other teams had like screaming fans around the cages. It was properly threatening atmosphere and we lost on it. Just got, and again, it's that thing of getting beaten game after game and you can't go home. You've just got to just take the medicine. Similarly, I remember entering a chess tournament when I was at school, like representing my school. But again, and it's a round robin thing. You had to go from table to table playing game after game. And every time you had to, the teachers would write the results up on the board. And the first guy was rubbish and I beat him comfortably. And once again, I remember thinking, this is it. Chess is my thing. I remember the teacher writing the under my name and thinking, I'm going to blitz these guys. And then once again, it turned out he was an outlier game after game, just getting taken apart by these, but it was the same problem. Couldn't go home. My dad was picking me up in 3 hours. So I think I lost like six on the bounce and you're just absolutely broken by the end of it. Chess is horrible for that as well, because pretty quickly when you sit down with someone, you get a sense that they're better than you immediately. And you know, you, especially at that age, when you haven't been playing for that long, you think, oh, this, there's no way I can beat this guy because he just knows what to do.
Everything you do is a step to is reacting to them. You can't ever get the front
exactly.
Foot. You're like, let's just get this over with. We know where it's heading. Let's just, you know.
Exactly. That,
put me out my misery.
I used to be all right at chess and I'd play it. I'd represented my school a couple of times, but yeah, you'd know straight away because, yeah, your hand would be on the piece moving it and they were already waiting to react to it. You're like, right, okay, not that.
it's not a sporting misadventure, but you must have some cracking stories of things going wrong on the comedy circuit when you've been performing.
You go through a fair bit certainly in your early career. You get butchered. You'll just take any gig anywhere, and it can be like, I remember turning up at one gig for like 30 quid or something, and I think before, it must be well before smartphones and stuff, so I just followed the A to Z to the address they gave me, and I thought, this can't be right. It was a leisure centre. It was just a sports centre. And like someone had just got the idea that they could have a comedian just. So I just was led into this room and just, like a gym, people jumping on trampolines, all this sort of stuff, doing exercise. And the guy was like, they didn't even have a. I said, do you have a kind of a microphone? And he said, oh, I think we have got one somewhere. God knows why they thought there should be a comedy. So I just had to stand there. I think I did half an hour, just like, of course, no one was listening. They were just getting on with their workouts. And like a lot of the people imagine that your worst moments would be like hostile crowds. And that can be quite hard. But when you're a kid and you're quite fearless, at least there's a bit of adrenaline around those sort of gigs. And you're like, all right, well, I can look after myself here. Your worst memories are ones where just no one is paying any attention. You can just hear yourself talking for ages. And that's not happened to me for a while. Although during the lockdowns, I did some quite a lot of driving gigs. I hosted these driving gigs where everyone would show up in their cars. And especially in the early days of the pandemic, you couldn't even have the windows down. People just had to honk their horns basically to which was quite funny.
Okay, to stop. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of those where it was just out in the open. There was a stage, but it wasn't very well covered. So I remember like the rain and wind blowing in, and you can't see a living soul. You could just see people's windscreens frosting up, and no real sign of lockdown's ending or anything. And that did feel like, oh, this is just, God, the world has ended here now. I'm the last person doing comedy in a sort of post-apocalypse.
I wanted to ask how you got into the snooker podcast. I don't know what the backstory is to how that came into being. Was it you that came up with the idea, or someone approached you? Or?
I was approached by World Snooker. I've been publicly sort of a snooker fan for quite a few years, and they approached me and they said, we'll pair you with a big snooker name. And when they suggested Henry, I thought it would never happen, basically, because a lot of these things end up being pie in the sky. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do a podcast with you. And I had a similar relationship to him with Chris, i.e. I didn't know him at all, but I'd grown up with him being an absolute colossus of the game. If anything, we've talked about this on the podcast, I didn't really like him as a because it was in that era where he won every year. Yeah. Sampras won Wimbledon every year. Man United always won. You know, Hendry is in my mind, like, represents that 90s period where certain people dominated sport so much that it got
Schumacher in F1.
Schumacher in F1. It was just, it felt like years went by and you never saw any sort of change. And then suddenly they got back. They didn't get in touch for weeks. It was quite, in my line of work, a lot of these things get talked about and then never happen. And then suddenly I've got an email saying, yep, Stephen's up for it. And then I'm like, ah, shit, I have to. I met him the first time. Luckily, the first one we did was in the flesh, in a club in London. So it was a bit less weird, but in another way, more weird, because he just walked in and started chatting. And it's meeting sports people is pretty odd in a way. I never really get starstruck meeting a film star or actor or other, because it's at least similar to my line of work. But if it's someone you grew up watching for years, it is very strange to actually see them in the, and it's really fun. I mean, yeah, Stephen's interesting because he still does play and he still enters tournaments and stuff, and he jokes about the fact that he can't quite be bothered to practice that much these days, but he also can't stop playing completely because it's in his blood, obviously. So he's got a weird relationship now where he has to, a guy that's been, he's one of the greatest of all time, he has to sometimes now go to someone like Barnsley and just get beaten by a like ambitious 19-year-old kid, and the kid is thinking, oh, this guy used to be my hero. But he doesn't want to quit, I don't think, because he can't imagine life without snooker. But every time you talk to him, every time we make the podcast, he's just been playing golf, or he's on his way to play golf. His commitment to golf is much, much bigger now than his snooker career.
Is he a good golfer? Is he quite a handy golfer?
He sounds like he's pretty good. He lives near, is it Sandringham? He lives on a, like near, he's a member of a famous golf course. So I think he plays, and he's always playing like pro-am golf events and stuff like that. But yeah, it's funny. It's funny to chat to someone who's been one of the greatest of all time in the world, but it's not even his main sport anymore. If he was still putting that much effort into snooker, he probably still would be in the world's top 16. But you know, I think he's very at peace with it, because there was nothing left that he didn't achieve. Obviously, all his world titles, and he won everything. So he knows he's got, his legacy is secure, but at the same time, he can't resist that the bug is, he plays a lot of exhibitions and stuff by the sound of it. And but it's funny hearing him talk about it, because it's quite rare that someone has been an absolute giant of their sport, but still lives I don't think you'll see Djokovic continuing to play, even if he's getting beaten by the world number. Andy Murray's still playing, but he still is pretty good. It interests me what it would be like to have tasted the absolute highest level, but still be playing against people that, you know, Stephen will say, I know I'm better than the guy, but I'm not going to beat him. The guy has been putting in the hours. You know, it's weird.
It must be. It's a kind of double-edged sword, that type of sport, like snooker, golf, whatever, that you, in theory, you could keep playing it into your later years. You know, you could play at 60, 70, 80 years of age, you could still be playing in theory.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, for me in my sport, there is no choice. You know, you get to a certain age, you're not going to be physically strong enough to keep doing it at a high level. and you do it for fun, but you wouldn't be competing at an international level.
No, you're
right. So I guess that takes a choice away from you. But these guys, it's like, well, why are you not still, you know, you should be out there still playing. Go on, show us what you've got. And maybe it's the expectation that they feel they have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a lot of Stephen's near contemporaries, like Higgins, Mark Williams, a lot of the best, well, Ronnie, a lot of them were also the best players 20 years ago. So, yeah, there's no, snooker's almost unique that you can be still into your 50s and be as good as you used to be, yeah. But as you say, that puts the pressure. In a way, it must be nice to, what age were you when you thought it's starting to go a bit? It must be a pretty short life as a
yeah. Well, I was quite late in terms of when I peaked in sprinting and track cycling. You'd normally mid-20s, early to mid-20s, you're at your peak physically. But I didn't win my first Olympic title till I was 28.
Yeah.
And then Beijing was 2000. I was 32 in Beijing. And then London was, I was hanging on, you know, I was 36. Yeah. That's the oldest anyone's been still winning Olympic golds in the sprinting world. So it was basically from the moment I won my first Olympic title, the media were kind of asking, when are you retiring? So from the very first one onwards, it was every time you lost a race, it was like, is this the start of the decline? Yeah, it's going now. So you're consistently trying to deny that your age mattered and you know, arguing against it. But in the back of your mind, there was always this little seed that thinking every time you lost a race, you thought, is this the start of the end? You know, and so you had to kind of push that out.
I mean, Steve Redgrave set a slightly unfair standard in a way, because he should have still been winning golds at that age.
I mean, he was, I guess, different sports are interesting. In women's endurance cycling, a lot of the time the best riders are in their mid-30s or even later, certainly like marathon running as well. Endurance sport, you tend to see older athletes perform, whether it's the fact it's the volume of training year after year or ability to suffer or just the experience of it, who knows. But
yeah, it's interesting. I guess it's less explosive in a way, whereas a 21-year-old is always going to have the edge in a sort of sprint situation.
Yeah.
A lot of it must just be desire as well. Like Redgrave obviously was just a driven man, didn't need doing that. But I suppose for you though, the London was a pretty nice line to draw under it.
Yeah.
Not going to stick around for another 4 years.
No, it was. I did try and get back into training because the Commonwealth Games were in Glasgow in 2014, and that would have been the perfect send off. But I was just getting injured, and the form just wasn't there. And I think everything had been about London, and I just hung on until then. But no, I can't complain. It was great, and it was, you know, that having that home Olympics as the main focus for those 4 years after Beijing, that was what kept me going. But
it was after
Beijing that I met you the first time on 8 out of 10 cats.
Yeah, 10 cats on that. You passed the medal. Let us hold it. Yeah,
that's
still my only time handling an Olympic medal, I believe. Yeah, yeah,
that's right. I was the novelty guest. You know how they always have at least one sort of person who's in the news or whatever, and utterly terrified. You guys are all in your comfort zone, doing what you do best, and it was just like terrified, but equally
it's
amazing lovely. To meet all these comedy heroes that you see or you watch on the telly and you love so much. It was just so cool to be there and to meet you all.
I think we were all quite awed by you as well, because it's funny, sort of, it's a funny crossover of situations. I mean, that panel show format does mean you can get. Like someone like you can do that, whereas unlikely will be in an Olympic velodrome. you can't really just drop a comedian into that situation. Yeah, it was so.
You never know, Mark. You never know. One day you could be at Olympics, track cycling. Never give up on your dreams.
You can't give up on your dreams, but I think 44 is starting to look late for me to get. I mean, the squash
in Los Angeles. You could do it.
I was going to say it doesn't come in till 4 years from now. That's come a bit, has it come too late for me? Maybe 4 years is what I need to get. It'd be an honour as a 48-year-old to represent Great Britain on the squash court. If it comes up, it comes up.
You could always have a dream.
I think some squash players would raise their eyebrows if it was me that got the nod, unless I've moved my way very rapidly through the rankings by that time.
Nepotism. Yeah, you find out you kind of got your way in there somehow.
Yeah.
Great aunt is the head of the Squash Federation, and you find your way in the team. There'll be questions asked in Parliament.
I think it will take some of that, especially given a lot of these guys have waited their whole careers for squash to even be in the Olympics. Some of them are disappointed to get overlooked for a guy that has only just taken it up. Yeah.
If you had one sport that you, or if you could be the best in the world in any sport, of any sort at all, what would be your dream? If you were kind of shutting your eyes and saying, imagine yourself World Cup final in football or the Olympic 100 meter final or Formula One or whatever.
Yeah, interesting.
What would your dream be?
It is interesting. It's basically a choice between the team glory or individual glory, I think. Like, I always think with tennis, it'd be, I mean, the financial rewards, obviously, but also just if you're top level, the glamour of being one of those players, going around the world, playing tournaments, and like obviously the acclaim you get as an individual. But I think my instincts are as a team player, really. I think I would say football, but it does come with quite a lot of caveats, which is obviously the stress you're under, the stick you get as the best footballer is like not even to be the best player in the world or in the world, just to be like Harry Kane or someone would be in theory amazing. But again, I wouldn't actually want to have to take those penalties for England World Cup or like the strain that. Again, people say, oh, if you get that, if you're being paid that much, you can do it. But that's not the point. I don't think there's any amount of money that I'd be able to take a penalty in a shootout. So I suppose what I'm saying is I'd choose to be one of the best footballers in the world, but part of the deal would need to be that I'd have the temperament to do that as well. Just had the talent, but you had my sort of nervous disposition. It wouldn't matter how good you were. You'd not be able to walk out on the pitch. I think the top players in any sport must have an ability to just switch the brain off a bit, just get into that, just do the job. That you can't be thinking, if I miss this penalty, the whole country's going to be. Because I thought it about Kane, in fact. He missed that penalty in the World Cup. But he comes back and there's no drop in his form. And he's now in the, you know, he even in that game, he was still, you know, that they always say, like, the best strikers miss far more chances than you think, but they will score, they'll keep going. They're not crushed by it. Or a cricketer gets out for a duck, but still walks out there the next time. I think that's what's maybe the thing I'm most envy about top sports people is not the talent. It's being able to like publicly fail at that and then just get up and go again. That must be tough. Certainly with tennis, like even like with tennis, if I put the first serve in the net, my brain would immediately be going, this will be a double fault now. I can see how easily you could. And so snooker players talk about it quite a bit on the podcast. You have a bad run of form and you sort of can't remember what it was even like to be good. I think in the end, I'd always choose to be a team sportsman rather than an individual, I think, because that loneliness of, having said that, being a stand-up is also very much an individual sport. And in a way it's less pressure because it is just you that you can let down. Like the thought of letting down a team, I think something like cricket would be almost the worst because you're in a team, but you're also, if you're going out to bat, you're on your own. Like if you're out for nothing, then you've disappointed your team and yourself.
But the kind of analogy between sport and comedy, there must be something about that being in the spotlight. This is all about me enjoying, relishing the challenge, the pressure, and being able to react on your feet to be able to, you know, because you go in, okay, now you're a big enough name that you have a dedicated fan base that will come and buy your tickets and they know what they're going to get. But in the early days, you know, the open mic turning up, it must have been terrifying, exhilarating, everything at once.
Yeah, I think that there probably are parallels between someone starting out in stand-up and someone trying to make it as like a golf or a tennis player. You when you're a nobody and you're like as a stand-up, an open mic, you're the equivalent of like world number 375 going out to play. You know, you're just going to have to take some beatings. And I think actually it is true. Like I'd done sketch stuff and things at university. What appealed to me about stand-up was that you are completely reliant on yourself. So if you have a funny idea or a joke, or like you have to run it past anyone. You are your own. So in that respect, I suppose it is like an individual sport. When you look in the mirror and you're like, I live or die by my performance here. No one else can really affect it. So that is a parallel. I guess there's also a parallel that I always say to young comedians, the main attribute is just wanting it enough and like keeping at it, basically sheer perseverance. You've got to be good at it, but a lot of people are really talented and they're not prepared to do that graft. I think that's where it is similar to sport. I've never met a top sports person who didn't at some point say most of it is just about just attrition, just getting out every day and doing it. And that was my approach. I did hundreds of gigs where you're not making any money and you're getting back at 2 a.m. And again, I mean, there's some exceptions, but most successful comics, they've just by the time you get to know who they are, they've done a lot of thankless time. And I think that's the same with sport. I think what marks people out in any field, the successful people, is they've sat out on that path and they've just been prepared to just get beaten up as much as possible. And then you still want to do it after. People always say with stand-up, it's 5 years. Like, after 5 years, if you're still doing it and there's some signs of progress, then you're over the worst of it. But like with anything, that's not, or same with sport. You could have, the difference is, I suppose, what I always think is really cool about sport is an injury can just basically destroy it after, like you can spend those 10 years and then when you're 24, you do an ACL and you're never quite the same again. There aren't as many comedy related injuries, but they're mentally.
Mental scars.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's true though, you know, what's the saying? You've got to, it takes 10 years to become an overnight success or whatever it is. You know, it's very true, I think.
That's the truest, one of the truest things about success, I think, that I've heard. Yeah. People often, when a comic gets, I remember when McIntyre got famous, or Ramesh more recently, people saying, have you come across this guy? And there are always people that within the circuit, like, yeah, I've been working with him for years. But obviously when someone appears on telly, it does seem as if they've just been plucked from nowhere. But even Jack Whitehall had, since you mentioned him, had like quite a meteoric rise to, but he'd done the crappy gigs and stuff. He'd maybe had a quicker rise than some people have got on telly a bit faster, but it's literally, as with sport, you can't just come out of nowhere. And again, people think that when a sports person, like a footballer, is 17 or 18, it's like, oh, he's getting all this money, he's got star treatment, he's come. But again, he will have worked since, he will have been in an academy since he was eight or she, or, you know, I think the most commonly overlooked thing about successful people is the stuff they've done that you haven't seen before you had a clue who they were.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, listen, we've used up more than the time that we had told you we would. But before we let you go, Mark, and thank you so much for joining us, tell us about your tour. Where can people find out about it? Where can they get tickets from?
Well, the way to do it is just look on Twitter. It's Watson Comedian, or Instagram. It's always Watson Comedian. Or my website is markwatsonthecomedian.com. I had to call it that because there's someone else out there that was called by Watson. You got the internet first. But I'm pretty easy to find, and there's loads of tour shows. I've done about, there's 102 shows on the tour, so it's careless if you miss me, really. I think I'm about 60 in, just past halfway, loads still to get. It goes through to November, and even then I'm always doing other stuff, and I'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe on and off as well, so yeah.
Any leisure centres without microphones?
Well, not that I know of, not officially on the tour, but I'm... hopefully, I mean, these days I'm in a leisure centre to play squash quite a bit, so I could turn it on its head and start a comedy night there, I suppose. We'll see. Yeah.
It's a new niche, you could start a new thing.
There's a lot of them out there, yeah. You can be squash courts have those viewing galleries sometimes. You could have the crowd up there. Yeah, I can see. Well, I'm going to get in touch with them now.
You heard it here first. Well, listen, thanks so much, Mark. Really good to chat.
It's been a pleasure. And, lovely chat.
Great to see you so well. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Brilliant.
Magic.
All right.
Thanks, Chris.
Take care.
Good chat, mate. Take care.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.